Oh, how are you today?
Good afternoon.
Very well, thank you.
Good. All right. This is docket number 80018, Clark v. State. And this is our last argument of the day. As you can see, we've got Justice Silver in the Las Vegas courtroom. And Justice Stiglitz is here with me in the Carson City courtroom. So I think we're ready to go. So, counsel, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Would you like to reserve any time?
I would, Your Honor, if I could have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Thank you. May it please the court. Justices, my name is James Ruggieroli. I represent Mr. Clark. He is the appellant. I would like to begin my argument by going straight to the analysis on the cumulative effect of the errors in this case, because I think it sets it up nicely. Obviously, the gravity of the crime here is serious, but the evidence is not so overwhelming as to have this case discharged for that issue. Moving to the issue of guilt, there are some important facts that I would like the court to be aware of. I know you're familiar with all of the briefings, but there are some things that, interestingly, were not disagreed to by the parties. And so there's a number of things that are the issues of guilt in the case, which we would argue are not close and certainly not overwhelming as to a first-degree murder charge or an attempt murder charge. There was a killing, but as you know, this is a situation of an argument of self-defense. So what we begin with the factual analysis is Mr. Clark, on January 22nd, 2012, is in his own home. He's with a couple of friends and family members watching movies. He is not out on the streets. He is not engaged in business. He is just having a nice family time at home. At least six acquaintances, and I would refer to them loosely as acquaintances, are out and about that night. They include Mr. Quincy Hill, the decedent, and Michael Lavender, the other individual that is eventually shot. They're out drinking, and they decide to go and visit Mr. Clark at his home without being invited. So they show up. Now, Mr. Clark testified in his own defense in this case, and he claimed that he was familiar with Quincy and Michael, that they had monikers, that he knew of a prior criminal record for each of them, and that Quincy had brought a stolen firearm to Mr. Clark's home. This is a very important fact because the state's witness, Zena Lavender, corroborated Mr. Clark's testimony. She indicated that it was true that Quincy brought a black revolver. The fact that this was a revolver and not a semi-automatic, I think, is another important fact that could come into play later when we discuss how this played out and the evidence that was recovered regarding a shooting. In any event, the parties agreed that at some point, a number of the individuals, if not everybody, went outside, and there was a fight that happened between Mr. Clark's nephew and Michael Lavender. Mr. Clark testified that he ran up and that Quincy drew his firearm at him. Mr. Clark retreated and fired in return. The state's witnesses all indicated that there was a little bit of a different version where Mr. Clark aimed the gun in the air, fired a warning shot, and then leveled the gun. But all of the state's witnesses indicated that they did not actually see what Quincy did, what Michael did at the time of the shooting, and did not actually see Mr. Clark shoot anybody. After the shooting, Mr. Clark assisted in putting Quincy in a car to get medical attention. I believe he drove with Michael in a car to UMC to get medical attention. The medical testimony from the expert in this case indicated that the trajectory of the wounds for Quincy followed in a left upward trajectory. Now, this would fit with the defense, Mr. Clark's testimony, that he was retreating and fired in essentially what would be an upward fashion. Police later come across two pistols. One is that .40 caliber that is a semi-automatic. The other is a .38 revolver. There was no DNA from the firearms for the revolver. Casings were found from only one gun. However, this is where it's important to note. If that revolver had been used, there would not be casings on the ground because it was a revolver. So no other forensic evidence against Mr. Clark was presented. Based on these recitations of facts, Your Honor, which most of them are not even in dispute, I do not believe it can be said that the evidence was overwhelming. At best for the state, these facts would indicate that there was a heat of passion killing, not a first-degree murder. And at worst for the state, this was an actual act of self-defense that is corroborated by many of the state's own witnesses, and it's not refuted. Mr. Clark's self-defense was not refuted by the evidence. So in looking at that second prong of the cumulative errors, the factual issues, we would argue strenuously that the issue of guilt is not overwhelming. At this point, we would get into the quantity and character of the errors. And I know that you're all familiar with the number of errors that we have presented. There are a lot of them. And so I would touch on a number of them briefly. Please, of course, if you have any questions, jump in. But the first error, it is the moment of the beginning of the trial where the court violates NRS 16.030. The state in their response indicates that these are just preliminary questions. These were eligibility questions. They dealt with citizenship, language, prior felony convictions. The court had an absolute duty to follow the statute. And from the very inception of this trial, before the jury had ever been selected or sworn, the court impermissibly failed to follow the rule of law. Now, as I go through the quantity and character of these errors, I know that many of them, standing alone, would not be sufficient to mandate a reversal. However, each of these errors, I would suggest, are a link in a chain, an unbroken chain of the cumulative errors that add up to reversible error. The second error is the prejudicial information and impression that the prospective panel received from, I believe it was only the third prospective juror. Now, this was the juror that the court specifically asked a response from regarding whether anyone knew anything about the witnesses in the case. And the state, I believe, is going to suggest that the response was something that could not have been anticipated and that it was spontaneous. But when you look
at Mr. Ruggieroli, looking at that transcript, yes, it's clear that what the district court did in front of that jury by threatening to call the sheriff and everything else. He didn't excuse the jury and then get out of here and don't be surprised if the sheriff calls. It's clearly improper judicial misconduct, but it wasn't objected to. So how does that play into the plain error? Because I just don't want you to waste your time on that because that's so obvious.
Thank you. It is so error that without even the objection, it's plain on its face. And especially when you consider that this is a self-defense claim, you've received information that should have been objected to, but it is so offensive from the very beginning. This very first instance when the jury is provided with what amounts to essentially inside information that could not have helped but to characterize Mr. Clark as a bad character from the very beginning, even though it was not objected to, I would suggest that it rises to the level of plain error. If the court does not see it as that high in this particular instance, that is again where I'm not trying to cop out, but because there were so many errors and because they were so egregious when you look at it from all the different aspects of the beginning of the trial all the way to the very end. So if we were to jump ahead, because I know that you might not want to spend time on each of the areas that I provided, and there are numerous. But if you go to the final error, it is the last instruction. So you've got the first, what Your Honor, Justice Silver has just pointed out. being a tremendous error that should have been objected to, was not properly remedied. But now you skip to the very end of the trial where the court has what we would suggest was improperly brings in an alternate juror and then advises the new panel, the new jury, that they can essentially take, and I want to be cautious here, what the court said. Now we're going to the very end. This is the last instruction to the jury before the new jury goes out to deliberate. How you deliberate, what you want to discuss, is up to you. So the very first things that the jury hear is impermissible misconduct. The very last thing that the court instructs the jury on is impermissible and misstates the law. It permitted the jury to go into that deliberation room with an alternate that had just replaced someone for having these extreme fears of danger, personal danger. And the court empowered the jury to go in and discuss anything that they wanted. The first question you would think that alternate would ask is, what happened? Why am I here? And the court never prevented the other jurors that had been exposed to all of juror number two's fears, never did anything to prevent the jury from talking about it, going through it, and tainting the alternate juror as well. I do hope that answered that portion of your question, Justice.
Thank you.
I don't want to belabor these individual points, but there were so many. I would suggest that if one individual example is not sufficient, that is why I really started this argument with, I'd ask the court to look at this in terms of the cumulative error case, because this man, Mr. Clark, did not receive a fair trial. He did not have an impartial jury. He did not have fair instructions given to him. I know that we deviated from the beginning of this to the end of the final instruction to the jury. If there are other questions, I'd be happy to answer them at this time.
Okay. Colleagues, any questions? All right. Thank you. You've got 3 minutes and 25 seconds left for your rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Schwartzer?
Thank you. Good afternoon. May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Mike Schwartz. I'm a Chief Deputy District Attorney. I was one of the trial attorneys on this case. I'm going to start out with something that was mentioned in our answering brief and was not really addressed in our reply, in the reply, and that is the law of the case. This was a case that's atypical because this was a case in which the notice of appeal was not filed in the proper amount of time and a post-conviction review was done first in the district court. An extensive order was done by Judge Johnson, who was not the trial judge. But
counsel, can
judge.
I stop you just a second? It looks like we're having some difficulties. We're not seeing you. Julie, do we notes? Is there a... Yeah? Have you turned off the video portion, or are you doing just audio?
No, my video is on. I can see everyone, and
okay,
the show's that's on.
All right, let's go ahead and continue. We'll see if we can figure out how to bring you back up on the screen.
May I proceed?
Yes.
Thank you. So after an order was done by Judge Eric Johnson, this was then appealed to the Nevada Supreme Court, in which an order was then issued, an extensive order by the Nevada Supreme Court that included Justice Stiglitz affirming everything except for remanding it back for Lozada, which leads us today. Now, in that order of affirmance, again, that was considered by this court, which was the first appeal this court considered, the court found in several places that there was a substantial evidence of guilt. And that is the words of this court, this body, not the word of the state. In the reply brief, Mr. Richard Rowley, counsel stated that the law of the case does not apply to direct appeals, but does not cite any case law to it. After doing extensive research myself while preparing for this, I don't see that being the issue. In fact, law of the case is often called law of the first appeal. And as in Walker v. State, the law of first appeal is the law of the case in all subsequent appeals in which the facts are substantially the same, should abide to it. And that's Walker v. State, which also states State of Loveless. And this is something the U.S. Supreme Court has said is important as well, which is the rule of law of the case is a rule of practice based upon sound policy that when an issue is once litigated and decided, that should be the end of the matter. The rule of practice promotes the finality and the efficiency of the judicial process by protecting against agitation of settled issues. And that is U.S. versus U.S. Smelting, Refining, and Mining Company 339 U.S. 186, 1950, which is one of many cases that cite law of the case. The jury issue is something that was considered by this body when considering the first appeal in this case. And in that, specifically, let's go to the first part, and I want to go into the first, the jury issues, then I want to go into the facts, because there are some major differences in the facts, how Mr. Ruggieroli stated it and how the state believes it was presented at a trial. And being the trial attorney, I do believe there was things that were not touched upon. But going regarding the first issue regarding this individual who was a custodian of LVMPD, even though this was a North Las Vegas case, who just did this outburst. This court found that the district court dismissed the member, and then this, I'm quoting directly from the order of affirmance, the district court dismissed the member and then instructed the entire panel that his statement was not evidence and could not be relied upon. The court then inquired of the panel if anyone did not understand these instructions and no one indicated a problem. So again, this court found that there wasn't an issue regarding that specific juror problem.
Since that time, and I can't remember offhand, we've issued an opinion regarding just Scotty flipping out on a juror too. And Hardesty wrote it, and both Stiglitz and myself are on that. So since the order in this case came down, we clearly called out error. And when you look at the fact that the district court judge told this juror he's going to call the sheriff on him, are you telling this court that the court didn't commit judicial misconduct based on our more recent opinions, which would take precedent over this order?
I apologize, Justice Silver. I didn't mean to interrupt you in your question. I do believe there's a big, I believe there is a distinguishment between the two. Judge Scotty, from my understanding of that case, threw a book at an individual who said that they could not be fair.
No, he didn't throw, I'm sorry, he didn't throw a book at the individual. He just threw a book against the wall.
So there was an outright showing of anger. In this case, Judge Tao did not have a similar outburst of anger. I would say that he noted the fact that it was improper to go on and say what was said, which was improper. Now, should have been done maybe outside the presence of other jury members? Possibly. But I do think there's a big distinguishment between that case and this case regarding that. Additionally, unlike the case you just cited to, Justice Silver, in this case, Judge Tao addressed the entire panel and said, does anything that was said, would that affect your ability to be basically fair and impartial? And there was no indication that anyone would have an issue regarding that. So unlike the case you cited to, and I understand it happened obviously post this case, there was a remedy, there was some instruction, there was some conversation with the rest of the jury panel after this incident then occurred to further show that this jury panel could be fair and impartial. So I think
Mr. Schwartzer, I want to direct you a little bit because there was no objection, unlike the case that I've just alluded to. So there's no objection. We're looking at plain error here, but we're also looking at plain error as well on the barrel issue for the judge going into preliminary questions and not strictly adhering to the statute, putting the jury under oath. So if we're to find that there are several errors here under plain error, how is there not cumulative error in this case? I'd appreciate an argument on that.
I don't believe there, and I'll get into it a little bit, Your Honor, but I don't believe there is cumulative error. In fact, in most of the issues raised by appellate counsel, this body beforehand found that there was an error, and even if there was, and it kind of denied it twice, said there was no error for most of the jury stuff, for the prosecutor misconduct stuff and the judicial misconduct stuff. And even if there wasn't enough to reach to affect the outcome of the case, and even considered a cumulative error argument in the first appeal in this case. So I would argue that there wasn't cumulative error because there wasn't there. Even if you consider this one portion an error, the portion when it comes to the preliminary questions, which I'll get into as well, the rest of the arguments here, such as evidence of guilt, where this body itself has found a significant evidence that there was significant evidence of guilt in this case, When it comes to prior inconsistent statement or prior consistent statement, which I don't believe there was an error. When it comes to flight, there's no error. When it comes to the Crawford, there was no request for Crawford, there was no error. I don't think there's cumulative error in this case. Going into the question you specifically asked about, which is the barrel, which obviously barrel came off through this case as well, I would quote a case that Justice Stiglitz wrote, which is the Jeremias case, v. State 134 Nevada Advance Opinion 8, in which it was in that opinion, it was stated that structural error could be waived if not objected to. And in fact, there's other cases in which those preliminary questions, in fact, even more than those preliminary questions, were not asked under oath, and it was not objected to, and it was found that that was waived based on the fact there was an objection at the time. Specifically, one that comes to mind, just because my wife happened to work on it, was Washington v. State, which is 134 Nevada 1028-2018, in which Judge Smith did not, I believe it was Judge Smith, it might have been another judge at the time, I know Judge Smith was the original judge on the case, did not swear people under oath, the jury under oath for the entire panel, but since it wasn't objected to, again, that was found to be, it was found to be waived and that there wasn't a plain error. Although I agree, Barrel v. State has now shown that you should swear people in for those first four questions that we all ask in the beginning of the jury. There is case law since then that shows that just because you don't ask it for those four questions doesn't mean that this case gets overturned or that that's necessarily an error. So on top of that, Your Honor, I want to go into kind of the facts of the case since obviously that seems to be...
Mr. Schwarzer, yeah. Hi, it's Justice Stiglitz. I want to ask a couple questions about a couple other pieces of evidence briefly.
Sure.
So the cross-examination of Clark, where Clark on direct, his attorney asked him why he didn't report the shootings to the police. And he said he reported them to his attorney. On cross, then the state re-asked that question if he had called the police. He said he reported it to his attorney. Then the state asked, what specific things has your attorney helped you with? Help me with how the first question opens the door to the second question. And then I have one more piece of evidence I want to ask you about.
Absolutely, Justice. So my co-counsel's cross-examination. I think it was a surprise to everyone that he called an attorney because there was obviously no police report that stated that. That attorney never contacted the police. So I think when it comes to a self-defense case and you're talking about credibility, I think there was some question whether we believed he actually called an attorney or not. So there was further question about, like, why would this individual have it to be a civil matter or a criminal matter? So I think that's what my co-counsel was trying to do during that cross-examination. I would obviously note, and I know it's in our brief as well, that the answer that eventually came out, I would believe would be harmless and in fact helpful to Mr. Clark, in which it showed that there was a case that was dismissed because he was a legal gun owner, because it was a CCW misdemeanor case that was dismissed once it was shown that he had a CCW card. But that would be my belief of why that door was open, was because, again, we're questioning the veracity and credibility of his statements when his statements are so different from the statements of every other witness that we have.
Okay. Second area, thank you. On the monikers, when Clark testified about the use of the monikers by the victims, I think it was Craze and Q Murder, the state,
correct,
through its either argument or questioning left the, both through its argument, I'm sorry, its questioning and then an argument, left the impression that the defendant had just kind of made that up out of whole cloth. It's the first time at trial, which is a very artful way to say it, because the state was well aware those were in fact the monikers for the victims. So how is it proper for the state to leave that misimpression with the jury?
This is something that was addressed in the first appeal as well, Your Honor, and it was our Justice, yeah, Stiglitz. And there's and in that case, it was noted in the case note that this body was troubled by that. I would argue that we were not trying to leave an impression that Mr. Clark lied regarding the monikers of these individuals. What was noted was he's the only individual that mentioned which is true testimony, that mentioned, that called these individuals by those names. And the reason why he's calling these individuals by these names, Q Murder and Craze, which are, you know, obviously names that could be disparaging in a case like that, is because it takes away from the story that he tells the jury, which to me and what was argued was a story that could not be true based on the forensic evidence and the facts of the case. So it wasn't so much that he was lying about the monikers, which comes out and the monikers come out multiple times, obviously, throughout his testimony, but that he's specifically doing it in order to disparage the victims in the case, because both individuals are obviously victims in this case. So I would argue that we were not trying to apply that they were lying, but in fact, that would be our argument for it.
But you agree that the record suggests that by the questioning.
I mean, I don't necessarily agree. I understand that's the reading of this court on it. Obviously, in the first appeal, the court obviously read it that way. During the closing argument, that's not how it felt it was being argued. But, you know, I understand that words on a page feel differently than what's being spoken at sure. closing. But I can I understand that that's this court's interpretation, and I'm obviously not going to challenge this court's interpretation from the first appeal. But I do want to get into something real quick about the facts, which is the one Mr. Ricciarulli mentioned, the revolver. The revolver was found, and there was testimony regarding the revolver under CSA Fisher's testimony. And when that revolver was found, it was fully loaded. So we know no shots were fired from that revolver. It was a 5-shot revolver, and this is all testified to in the jury trial. So to say that, well, we wouldn't have found casings because the revolver was used, well, that's true, but we actually had the revolver, and the revolver was fully loaded and was not used, unless after Quincy Hill died, he somehow reloaded that firearm. So what we have is going again to the fact that this court has found that there was substantial evidence of guilt numerous times in the first appeal in this case. You have 4 witness testimonies. Two of the witnesses do state that Mr. Clark did shoot Quincy. You have one type of casing found, which is the 9mm that Mr. Clark used. You have a blood trail from Mr. Lavender that shows he was shot while running away from the defendant, based on the positions of what where the applicant was and where Mr. Lavender's pool of blood was found. Mr. Lavender was shot 3 times, all 3 times in the back, once in the back of the right shoulder, once in the butt, and once in the left elbow. Additionally, you know, the fact that the defendant left and got a room in someone else's name and to stay away from his own residence for 10 days before he was actually apprehended is indication of guilt. And that his version of events make no sense at all. You have an individual who said 2 people were attacking with him at the gun at the same time, yet somehow these 2 individuals who are coming from different sides weren't able to even get 1 shot off, never mind the supposed gun that Michael Lavender had, was never recovered, even though Michael Lavender was obviously no place to hide it. So when you put all these, may I just finish up my
sentence? Statement, yes.
Okay. So when you add this all up, when you add up the first, how you consider the first appeal, the stuff in the arguments in our brief, and the facts as presented, Your Honors, the state believes that this should be affirmed, that this court got it right the first time while affirming it, and the court should affirm this case again the second time. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Ricciarulli?
Thank you. I would point out as first to the law of the case. Number one, the state did not cite any cases that specifically said that when applied to this context, when there has been obvious misconduct by not filing a timely appeal, it's missed, and then you start with an appeal from the denial of the post-conviction, that is the law of the case. I would point out, though, that there are exceptions, and this court is aware of them. This would fall under the extraordinary circumstances exceptions. I would point out I believe it's pronounced SU, HSU versus County of Clark, 123 Nevada, 625. That goes through a number of exceptional circumstances that result in actual prejudice. And one of them, I think, was mentioned by Justice Silver, where you have new law that comes out and it changes the context of things. I want to briefly point out that as to the law of the case, when a defense attorney is going through a post-conviction proceeding and they are limited, there's been no appeal, it is a very different way of approaching the issues in the case and looking at what happened at the trial and what is available to them. I think it would be an extreme disadvantage if a defendant is put in a position where, through no fault of their own, they did not receive a direct appeal, they had a post-conviction proceeding that did not flesh out all of the issues and did not capture all of the things, and especially did not take into account certain aspects of changing law, and then they lose their post-conviction, they appeal it, and then that is lost, but then the court graciously gives them the direct appeal right, which they did not have, and then on appeal, direct appeal, the court says, well, you know, we really already looked at this, so you're going to be denied because the law of the case, we pretty much already covered everything. I don't think that is the standard. I certainly don't think it should be the standard. Just briefly talking about a couple of extra instances, the judicial misconduct was not the only misconduct in the case. The way a defense attorney would ask questions and deal with the issue on post-conviction about prosecutorial misconduct would be different. Also, and so the things that were brought up about the specific instances, these are egregious, and they are not the only instances of misconduct. The prosecutorial misconduct during the cross-examination of Mr. Clark, the prosecutor was persistent. He indicated, I'm going to keep asking you this until you answer what specific things has he helped you with legally. This creates the impression of somebody that needed legal counsel. And that's why all of this really does fit together. That is an attack on character. And when you have a self-defense case, and when you have statements that are made at the very beginning of a trial that specifically involve allegations about a defendant, not just, I don't have time to serve on a jury panel, I've got things in my life, but I know the officers involved in this case. This is a far situation, so there is plain error. It's cumulative error at its lowest.
Okay, thank you. Colleagues, do you have any additional questions?
No, thank you, Chief.
Justice Silver?
Oh, no, thank you.
Okay, counsel, thank you for your arguments today, and we appreciate you being here. This case will stand submitted, and this court will stand in recess.